Okay, welcome to this briefing. Let's start. Today is Friday, 18th of October. We are here in Geneva at the Information Service of the United Nations. And I would like to, first of all, welcome you all, including the students of the University of Zurich. Welcome to the briefing. We also have a little change in the program that has been distributed to you, because Rania Dagash-Kamara, the World Food Program Assistant Executive Director for Partnership and Innovation, has moved our briefing to Tuesday. And this is also in the interest of the news and of the other speakers that we have aligned this morning. And the first one I would like to welcome is Andrea Tenenti, the spokesperson, chief strategic communication and public information for the UN interim force in Lebanon. Andrea is connected, comes to us from Beirut, and I would like to really welcome him. I'm happy to see you in good shape, Andrea. And we are really happy that you're here for briefing the journalist in Geneva. So as usual, we will give you the floor for initial remarks, and then we will open the floor to questions. Andrea, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Sandra. Thank you very much for having UNIFIL during your press conference today. I will start with a few minutes of opening remarks in relation to the situation in South Lebanon. For the last several months, but after over 12 months of exchanges of fire between Hezbollah and Israel, tensions have escalated exponentially in the past month, turning the hostilities into a deadlier, more lethal conflict. According to Lebanese authority, the death toll in Lebanon since the 8th of October of last year has reached over 2,400 people, and the number of wounded individuals has increased to over 11,200. Close to 800,000 people were internally displaced, 60% of them from UNIFIL area of operations. This is according to the International Organization for Migration. In recent days, the amount of heavy shelling and powerful airstrikes, as well as the number of air violations over Lebanese airspace have grown. There has been also significant increase in bombardment, particularly in southern Lebanon, where UNIFIL operates, but also in Beirut and other parts of the country. Daily heavy shelling has worsened due to IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, incursions into Lebanese territory in the proximity of the Blue Line and in both UNIFIL sector, east and west, which constitute a violation of Lebanese sovereignty and also a violation of Security Council Resolution 1701. Peacekeepers are also reporting clashes on the ground. The mission continues to stay in contact with the parties, urging de-escalation and also reminding them of their obligation to ensure peacekeepers' safety. Due to the security situation in the past few weeks, most but not all patrols have been suspended until things improve. We continue to monitor and report from all our UN positions across the south of Lebanon. We are also working hard behind the scenes to coordinate the safe passage of essential humanitarian aid to civilians in South Lebanon by UN agencies and local international NGOs. Civilians continue to suffer in this conflict, and peacekeepers continue to do whatever we can to help. Despite IDF demands to move from position close to the Blue Line, a unanimous decision was taken by all UNIFIL troops contributing countries and the UN Security Council, and our peacekeepers remain deployed in all their positions along the Blue Line. We are regularly adjusting our postures and activities and contingency plans ready to activate if absolutely necessary. We are seeing at the moment hundreds of trajectories and sometimes more crossing the line each day, forcing our peacekeepers to spend extended hours in shelters to ensure their safety, which remains our top priority. The escalation along the Blue Line is causing widespread destructions of towns and villages in South Lebanon, while rockets continue to be launched towards Israel, including civilian areas. The devastation and destructions of many villages along the Blue Line and even beyond is shocking. The IDF has repeatedly targeted our positions, endangering the safety of our troops. in addition to Hezbollah launching rockets toward Israel from near our positions, which also puts our peacekeepers in danger. Security Council Resolution 1701 has been significantly challenged, but its key provisions on safety, security, long-term solutions remain valid and must be implemented. UNIFIL Level Mission and Force Commander Lieutenant General Lazaro continues to maintain open channel of communications with both sides, and we continue to urge Lebanon and Israel to commit to Resolution 1701 in actions and not just with words. And this, as we continue to say, is the only viable solution to bring back stability in the region. Thank you, and ready for your questions.
Andrea, thank you very much for this briefing. And let me, before opening the floor to question, remind to the journalists that yesterday we have distributed a solidarity message that the Secretary General of the United Nations has addressed to the UN interim forces in Lebanon, in which he says that he is full of admiration and gratitude to the men and women of UNIFIL, including Andrea. He said, "I'm so proud of you. I know your countries are proud of you too." He's reaffirmed that the safety of UN personnel is our highest priority, and all parties have an obligation to ensure the safety of our personnel. He continued by saying the inviolability of UN premises must be respected at all times. And despite all the challenges, as we have heard from Andrea, UNIFIL remains in its position. The Secretary General said, "I'm in constant contact with General Lazaro, assessing the latest developments. Our path forward is clear. We need an immediate ceasefire and the full implementation of Resolution 1701. You are," he said to the men and women of UNIFIL, "you are not just on the blue line in Lebanon, you are literally on the front line of peace." And I open the floor to question now. I'll start with Emma Farge here in the room. Emma is our correspondent of Reuters, Andrea.
Thank you. Good morning, Andrea. I had a question about something you sent out on X yesterday about a drone that was brought down. You said electronic countermeasures were used. By whom? Who actually shot down this drone? And have you identified this drone yet? Who sent it? And what were its intentions? Thank you.
Andrea?
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Yes, we issued a statement yesterday because an unknown drone approached one of our maritime task force ship. We used the MTF, the ship used electronic countermeasure also to decrease the threat to the ship. The drone then exploded on its own. We are still looking into this matter. We still don't know the origins. We understand that the drone was coming from the south, but circling around the ship and getting very, very close, a few meters away from the ship. So these measures were used. We are launching an investigation to understand the origin of the drone. So as soon as we have more information, we will get back to all of you. Thank you.
Jamie Keaton, Associated Press. Yeah, I think that one works.
Hello, Mr. Tenenti. Thank you for coming to see us. I have two questions. The first is, what do you say to people, critics who say that there is no peace in the region and that UNIFIL's utility, its purpose, is kind of obsolete, given the fact that there's obviously no peace being kept in the region? If you could just emphasize sort of the successes that you've had over the years that actually prove that this peacekeeping operation is still valid. And secondly, I'd like, if you could, please, to specify instances, starting with the most recent, in which UNIFIL peacekeepers have had to discharge their weapons in one direction or another, or are they generally just sitting there and facing incursions, as you've mentioned, without being able to respond in any way? Thank you.
Andrea.
Thank you very much. In relation to the first part of your questions, I think the role of UNIFIL at the moment is more important than ever. We need to be here. We need to try to bring back stability and peace to this region. There was never peace. In fact, we were working to try to bring back stability and working on a long-term solution, but peace was never in this part of the region. Even despite in recent days when the Israeli Defense Forces and also Israeli Prime Minister asked the mission to move from our positions close to the blue line, there was an unanimous decision from everyone to stay. We are here deployed because the Security Council wants us to be here, because the international community. And at the moment with this conflict, it's very important to be able to monitor and report also to the Security Council, to the international community, what's happening right now. We have our limited capabilities at the moment in terms of patrolling, but we are still doing it. And most importantly is what we are trying to do and what we have been working for days and weeks to work together and to coordinate with UN humanitarian agencies, deconflict situation in order to bring back, assistance to local communities. There are thousands of people still stuck in villages in the south of Lebanon without the most basic needs. And that's what we are working in these days to try to bring this assistance. But the role of UNIFIL is still important. 1701 has definitely been challenged. But the main provisions are still valid. The full implementation of the resolution is not up to UNIFIL. We are here to support the implementation of Resolution 1701, but it's up to the parties to be committed to this resolution. So that, I just want to go back just for a second that from 2006, when Resolution 1701 was adopted and was the resolution that stopped the conflict in 2006, until last year, the south of Lebanon had witnessed one of its quietest periods in recent history. Then the events of October happened, and now, of course, we have to go back to the cessation of hostilities. There was a lot of things that were done until that point. It was starting to deploy more Lebanese army to the south. We were working on marking the blue line, a border that does not exist, and we had marked most part of the blue line, and we were working on the outstanding points along the blue line. We had monthly meeting between Lebanese army and IDF, two countries still at war, and meeting in the same room to try to deconflict situation and trying to move forward. So a lot was done. The Middle East and this region is very sensitive and it's very difficult region. So it moves very slowly, any kind of a negotiation. But that's what we were doing. We have to go back to that. 1701 is still the resolution that both countries have agreed to and both parties are somehow been committed to, and even recently they've been saying again and again that 1701 needs to be implemented, but we need the commitment of the parties. In relation to your second part of the question of self-defense, we are under Chapter 6 of the Security Council. Of course, self-defense can be used, but we also have to be very pragmatic on when to use it and how to use it, because we don't want to become part of the conflict and using force that could trigger more violence. This is not something what we are planning to do. So we're trying to decrease the tensions, and it's up to the commanders on the ground to decide when is the time to use self-defense. But it's very important at the moment to decrease the violence, to decrease the tension, and that's what we've been doing until now.
You have a follow-up?
Sorry.
A follow-up from AP?
Yes, please. Thank you. Can I just understand that there has not been any instance of discharging of weapons by UNIFIL forces? It sounds like your answer to that. And just as a quick question, you mentioned the mandate and the successes that you've had in getting aid to needy people and whatnot. What do you say to people who say that the UNIFIL zone that is supposed to be covered has not been fully covered as it should have been, and that, for example, some organizations posing as NGOs are actually representative of Hezbollah in the region that are coming into the area, and that UNIFIL may be turning a blind eye to those militants, I guess, if you want to call them that.
Right. No. Thanks a lot again for the follow-up questions, because that's what we've been doing. We have been reporting all these incidents and any suspicious activities to the Security Council. Is all part of the SG's report to the Security Council. So everything has been reported, even the recent claims by IDF on finding of channels. This has all been reported, but there is a limitation to Resolution 1701. We cannot search inside private property, and the one that was mentioning was a private property. We cannot search inside houses. We cannot disarm Hezbollah, which is not part of our mandate. So we have been requesting the Lebanese authorities to enter inside all these areas to inspect. We have not been able to do it. And as I said, this is a limitation of Resolution 1701. Of course, if there is any change or planning any change of resolution of the mandate of the mission, will be up to the Security Council to decide. But we did whatever we could within the limits of our mandate.
Thank you very much. About the discharging, so you... No.
That was not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let me go to the platform now. I have Laurent Sierro. Laurent is our correspondent of the Swiss news agency, ITS.
Yeah, thank you. The question on the drone was covered, so I have a few additional questions. First, do you make a direct correlation between the speeches against Finul that were made recently by Prime Minister Netanyahu and the different targets you were subjected to, and there were a few casualties, a few injuries within your force. And then, if you could tell us more a little bit about the mood currently of the men and women within the force, how are they dealing with that? And beyond the fact that they have to remain for hours in the compound, have they been asked to follow a particular precautionary measures? Thank you.
Andrea?
Thank you. In relation to the incidents and some correlation with what they asked us to do and what happened later, I think without commenting too much on that, I will just look at the facts. We were asked to move from some positions along the blue line. We have around 29 positions that are very close to the blue line, up to 5 kilometers. We decided not to. It's important for the UN flag to still fly there, and because we are there at the request of the Security Council, there was also a strong and vocal voice from the Security Council, from the international community, to stay there. Immediately after that, we've been targeted several times, 5 times, and a deliberate attack. One tower inside the headquarters in Nakura, 2 peacekeepers were injured, another 2 positions close to the blue line where they hit the communication system, the cameras, a drone entered very close to the bunkers where peacekeepers were sheltering. A few days ago, they entered IDF inside the UN position and they stayed there for 45 minutes. So there have been several days yesterday that there was another targeting of our cameras in another position. So all these elements are clear, and we've been very vocal. These are deliberate attacks against the mission. The parties have an obligation to protect peacekeepers. And it's not only a violation of Resolution 1701, it's also a violation of international humanitarian law. So we need to stay. They asked us to move, and we are there because it's important for the international community and the international presence to be there. The mood of peacekeepers, incredibly enough, after all these months, because this conflict did not start a month ago. We have been going on with the exchanges of hostilities started last October. There have been rotation of troops, but they're incredibly resilient in all the positions. And some of them, they're very challenging areas and shelters. So not easy when you spend many hours during the day inside shelters. It's very difficult. But I would say that the morale is still very high, the commitment. We have been talking to some of them, and we are in touch with peacekeepers from all the different positions, still very much committed to try to bring back some kind of stability in this region. So I would say that it's an incredible, very challenging situation, but peacekeepers are very much in a good spirit and committed to bring back some calm and stability to the region.
Thank you very much. Yuri Aprelev, RIA Novosti, the Russian news agency.
Yes, thank you, Andrea. Thank you for coming to this briefing. I have a question because I am so far not an expert on what was the mission of the UNIFIL. So I have a question as a newer. Why, despite these very serious incidents and violations that you are talking about, at least 5 peacekeepers that were wounded, tanks that entered UN bases, why there is no at least warning shots from the UNIFIL just to say that stop, this is going too, this is too dangerous? And because it is really hard to understand when it comes that peacekeepers are attacked without any reaction. That's really hard to understand. If you can explain at what point and when you will answer.
I think we have the Secretary General has said this several times, but I let Andrea answer.
Yeah, you know, self-defense is up to the commander of the ground. If there is a situation that the person on the ground, the commander on the ground, sees that it's necessary to protect peacekeepers, of course, they will be able to act in self-defense. But it's also important to be rational in these moments that if responding would trigger more violence, it's important to deconflict the situation instead of increase it. But as I said, it's possible to use it and could be used in case of a real threat against our peacekeepers. We had the first example that I mentioned when a Merkava tank hit a tower inside our UN headquarters. And two peacekeepers were injured, of course, responding with what? I don't know in that case. In other situations, I think it was much more useful to de-escalate the tension and discuss it also with this channel of communication that is still open between the head of mission and the parties and with the IDF. But definitely, the rules of engagement, they are very clear. Self-defense can be used. And at the moment, it's important to deconflict the tensions.
Thank you very much. Moussa Assi Al-Mayadine.
Merci beaucoup, Alexandra. I have two questions. The first one concerning the situation of the remaining residents in the area between Litani River and the border. And the second one, based in Resolution 1701, can Israeli air violations of Lebanon be considered a violation of this resolution, and if you have some details about how many of these violations were there last year. I speak here just for the violation of Israeli air, not the war between Hezbollah and Israel from 1 year. Thank you.
Thank you for the questions. In relation to the first part of the people in South Lebanon, definitely the situation is very dramatic because a large majority of the population, I would say around 450,000 people, left south of Lebanon. So I would say the vast majority of the population left and went to the north. Most villages along the blue line, they are completely destroyed and damages in all the area of operation. So the situation is very dramatic. And that's why it's important to ensure and to bring assistance to the local populations. As I said, it's been challenging, because most of the times we are not given the guarantees for safety for humanitarian convoys. And that has been limiting the capabilities of the mission to coordinate with humanitarian agencies. We were able to coordinate some of these activities in recent days. We hope to do more in the next few days, but the limitations are really due to the ongoing shelling, heavy shelling, and not be given the guarantees for safety for our troops. But the violations, I can get back to you in terms of how many, because there are enormous amount of air violations that have been registered by our radars. Maybe they're not even the full amount of air violations that IDF have been, Israeli Air Forces have been doing over Lebanese airspace. It's a large number of air violations, hundreds and hundreds of, if not more, of air violations on a yearly basis. So maybe through Alessandra, I can get back to you with the more of an approximate numbers from last year until now, even before.
Yes, indeed.
And again, it's a violation, of course. It's a serious violation of Resolution 1701.
Yeah, and for sure, if there is anything that we can distribute later on, including your notes, your introductory notes, Andrea, will do it with pleasure. Just housekeeping, I've got three more questions, then we will let Andrea go, because it's already very difficult to organize this, and we thank him very much for being here. So I'll give the floor to John Zarokostas, France 24, English Channel.
Yes, good morning. I also write for The Lancet, the medical journal. I was wondering, sir, if you could bring us up to speed in the area that you've been monitoring, if there's been any use of white phosphorus in southern Lebanon and what have been the implications of that? And secondly, in your peacekeeping monitoring operations, are you privy to use drones and also commercial satellites for your monitoring purposes? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, on the use of white phosphor, we had an investigation several months ago about the use of phosphor close to one of our bases, and there were actually a trace of the possible use of white phosphorus. I think it's also part of one of our report, SG report to the Security Council. Unfortunately, for the other instances, we don't have monitoring capabilities. We didn't have capabilities of investigating some of these reports, but I can share with you what DSG's report, what there was in the report of the Secretary General to the Security Council. This was one instance of a possible use of it. The second part of the question was, okay, the use of monitoring capabilities. No, we do not have drones or really satellite imageries. We are just monitoring the area of operations with our vehicles in coordination with the Lebanese army. It's also important to emphasize that everything we do is in coordination with the Lebanese army. We do have radar capabilities to monitor, especially during this period, the shelling, the exchanges of fire, monitoring, reporting that transparently to the Security Council. That's the capabilities we have within the UNIFIL peacekeeping mission.
Very clear. Lisa Schlein, Voice of America.
Thank you, Alessandra, and good morning to you. I would like to know what the IDF's justification for its aggressive behavior towards UNIFIL is, and do you accept this explanation that may be given to you? And then also, how many peacekeepers actually are there? Thank you.
Well, we didn't get real justification. We are still in discussion with the IDF to find out more. I understand from other sources that they are investigating these incidents. According to them, there was no targeting of peacekeepers, but of course we were very clear in our statements that what happened, it's a clear deliberate targeting of peacekeepers because there was no one else around, and in some instances we were not even at the highest level of securing the area of operation. There was not even exchanges of fire, and of course entering inside a UNIFIL base and stay there for 45 minutes is definitely a deliberate incident, a deliberate attack. So we still don't know, but we are still waiting for more justification for that. The second part of your questions.
Thank you. She asked how many UNIFIL staff you have on the floor, on the ground.
Yeah, at the moment, a little bit over 10,000 troops, 10,000 peacekeepers from 50 troop contributing countries, which is a very large number of nations, of countries that it shows again the commitment from the international community to bring back stability to this region that has been devastated by conflict for the last 12 months, with thousands of people being killed and injured.
Thank you. Last question is from Nika Mimbruce, our correspondent of the New York Times.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. You mentioned that there was another incident, another attack on a UNIFIL position yesterday, damaging cameras. I wonder if you could give me some more details. Was this small arms fire, shell fire, mortar fire? What kind of attack? What kind of damage was inflicted? Was this a manned position or a remote observation post? When these cameras are being shut up, are you replacing them? Do you have maintained, and are you sustaining your system of monitoring on the border? Thank you.
Yeah, we do try, of course, to fix not only the cameras, but also the T-walls that have been damaged. And the incident I think you're referring to is the one of 2 days ago, where I think was a Merkava tank that hit cameras in one position close to the blue line. It's a position was mainly manned by Serbian peacekeepers. And the previous one, cameras, is several days earlier. And it was cameras in a position very close to the blue line, also with Italian contingents in that position. But we try definitely to fix whatever has been hitting these days, mainly the security, the perimeters of all our position, because the T-walls of these bases and the gates of these gates have been heavily damaged, and also some of the containers inside from explosions outside. So we do have logistical movement. We try to bring, of course, everything we can to our contingent positions outside, but also to fix all the destructions that we have been suffering this during these months.
I am very, very sorry. I see more hands up, but Andrea has to leave, and I'm getting messages that he really has to leave. Andrea, thank you so very much.
Thank you, and they can send me the questions, so they can send us the questions, so yeah. I'll be happy to answer.
Absolutely, we can distribute your contact details. I see other hands coming up, but I'm really sorry. We are already very happy to have been able to listen from Andrea this morning. Andrea, you're really, you know, we are really proud of your work, but please stay safe and come back to brief the journalist here in Geneva. Thank you so very much, and also thanks to Danny for his technical support. So let me now, we stay on the Middle East and with the next two briefers, but we turn now to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory. I'll start with Jens. Jens, you have an update on the situation on the occupied West Bank from OCHA, and then we will hear from UNICEF on the situation of children in Gaza being displaced again. Jens, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Alessandra. I think Andrea has left, but I just want to say thank you to him and the team from OCHA as well for their bravery and their staying power, and not least their great collaboration around the humanitarian notification system, which he mentioned a bit of that. They're a critical part of that. And for this very important briefing from Lebanon, you remember a year ago, when we all warned, when this started in Israel and Gaza, we all warned that the region was a powder keg. It was a tinderbox. And look today, you know, we see this regional descent into some Dante's hell with no end in sight and no guarantee that it won't get worse. Mm. Part of that is, of course, the West Bank. And I want to say a bit about that. Last night, we issued our weekly update on the situation in the occupied West Bank, where the situation continues to deteriorate. In the latest reporting period, from the 8th to the 14th of October, Israeli forces killed 9 Palestinians, including a child, and injured 104 people, including 9 children. Israeli forces accused most of those fatalities of being involved in attacking Israelis. Yesterday, a Palestinian woman was reportedly killed while she was harvesting olives in Jenin. This follows 32 attacks by Israeli settlers this month on Palestinians engaged in the ongoing olive harvest happening right now. Hundreds of olive trees and saplings have been vandalized, sued off, or stolen. The olive harvest is an economic lifeline for tens of thousands of Palestinian families in the West Bank. We are currently assessing how we and our partners can support those who have been affected by this. Over the past year, 728 Palestinians in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, have been killed mainly by Israeli forces, but at least 12 of them were killed by settlers. In the same period, 16 members of the Israeli forces and 6 settlers have been killed by Palestinians. In Israel, attacks by Palestinians from the West Bank resulted in the killing of 16 Israelis, while 8 Palestinian perpetrators were also killed. Additionally, 277 Palestinian households, including nearly 800 children, have been displaced across the West Bank in the context of settler violence and access restrictions. Israeli authorities have demolished, confiscated, or sealed around 1,800 Palestinian structures, forcibly displacing nearly 4,600 other Palestinians. Dozens of these structures had been funded by donors and provided as humanitarian aid. Israeli forces have been using lethal, warlike tactics in the West Bank, raising serious concerns over excessive use of force and deepening people's humanitarian needs. We call on Israel, as the occupying power, to protect the Palestinians against attacks, violence, and intimidation. There are more details in our report, which is online, and I've sent you the link. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jens. And I'll turn to my left to hear from James on the situation of children, this time in Gaza.
Thanks, Alessandra. Gaza is the real-world embodiment of hell on earth for its million children, and it is getting worse day by day as we see horrific impact of daily airstrikes and military operations on Palestinian children. Let me try and share what that looks like through one specific child, a seven-year-old girl who I met very recently, Kamar. Okay, during an attack where she was living in Jabalia camp, Kamar was struck in the foot. The only hospital she could be taken to, given the hostilities, was a maternity hospital. That was then under siege for 20 days, by which time the shrapnel in Kamar's foot had turned to an infection. Because this little girl could not be moved, and because the hospital did not have the capacity to deal with the trauma cases that it was faced, doctors had to amputate Kamar's leg. Now, in any vaguely normal situation, this little girl's leg would never have been amputated. Kamar, her mother, and her sister, who was also injured, were then forced to evacuate on foot. And so a seven-year-old girl with a newly amputated leg was pushed from north to south. They now live in a ripped tent surrounded by stagnant water and other families enduring similar tragedies. Kamar is, of course, deeply traumatised. Regular sounds of bombings and raids only add to that. And there are no prosthetics in Gaza. Now, I share the story of this little seven-year-old girl because, as heartbreaking as it is, it's not unique. And right now, it is being repeated. Just over a year since orders were given to a million people to leave northern Gaza, hundreds of thousands of civilians are again being given evacuation orders to leave the north. Indeed, when you reflect on the current situation, the best feeling to describe it is deja vu, but with even darker shadows. Children have lived this nightmare before. It was hell a year ago. It's even worse today. So a year ago, the choice for civilians, as cruel as it was this: endure deprivation or flee into displacement. Today, deprivation grips all of Gaza. Being displaced again only leads to more suffering and ever worse conditions for children. Again, nearly a year ago, we were daily updating the number of trucks being allowed to make crossings into Gaza and to reach civilians. Today in the north, we are doing the same. Just 80 trucks carrying food and water assistance have been permitted into northern Gaza since the 2nd of October. Today in the south, where families are forced to flee, it's desperately overcrowded. It lacks, lethally lacks access to sanitation, to water, to shelter. Okay, so where do children and families go? They're not safe in shelters and schools, they're not safe in hospitals, and they're certainly not safe in overcrowded camps. Take Al-Mawasi, where Palestinians are frequently told to relocate. Al-Mawasi makes up around 3% of Gaza in terms of landmass. It had a population of 9,000 people before this war. It now has around 730,000. If Al-Mawasi was a city, it would be the most densely populated city on the planet. But Al-Mawasi is not a city. It has no high-rise buildings. It has no infrastructure. It has no capacity to host a population anywhere near this size. Most of its land is sandhills. Now, this is where seven-year-old Kamar and so many others are forced to live, still deprived of water and shelter and medicine, woefully short of mental health support, education, and, of course, safety. Indeed, perhaps the darkest irony in once again forcibly displacing families into these so-called humanitarian zones is beyond their lack of food, water and medicine, the three things that Israel has a legal obligation to provide, they are bombed. Al-Mawasi has had multiple mass casualty events. Attacks on schools have become unimaginable in frequency. 30 in just the last 2 weeks, and more than half of those, 16 in Jabalia. Now, somehow in this context, UNICEF has built thousands of toilets. We've given cash assistance to a million people. More than 300,000 children have benefited from our nutrition services. UNICEF and all the UN partners continue to plea for a long-term sustainable ceasefire. Well, now it's ceasefires, plural, when you talk of the broader region. For the return of hostages, for the unimpeded humanitarian access and a magnitude increase for all those essential humanitarian supplies. For funding for our programs, which remain remain dangerously underfunded, and for the prevention of threats to humanitarian workers, including through misinformation and disinformation, which has become rampant through this conflict. Now, despite these immense effort from very brave humanitarian workers on the ground, children continue to suffer unspeakable daily harm. 1 year from those first forced evacuations, we find the international community watching history repeat itself. If I may very quickly take another little girl I met earlier this month. When her family home was struck, her brother and sister were killed. This little girl suffered devastating injuries to her face. Her face was literally torn off. Now, surgeons have done some amazing work and they have held together the remaining structure, but she urgently requires a medevac. That has been denied multiple times. She's one of more than 10,000 patients urgently awaiting medical evacuation, each one with a similar tragic story. We have massive denials and restrictions of aid coming in and massive restrictions of severely wounded children going out. If this level of horror doesn't stir our humanity and drive us to act, whatever will. Again, deja vu with darker shadows. Last October, UNICEF said Gaza had become a graveyard for thousands of children. Earlier this month, I saw multiple new makeshift graveyards. Last November, UNICEF warned that if children's access to water and sanitation in Gaza continues to be restricted, then children face a serious threat of disease outbreak. Today, there is polio in Gaza. Last December, UNICEF stated the Gaza Strip is the most dangerous place in the world to be a child. And day after day, for more than a year, that evidence-based, brutal reality is reinforced. And yet, in spite of the statements, the hard data, the inferno of burning tents, the harrowing screams, the scores of children I've spoken with missing limbs, the desperate pleas from doctors for medicine, the denials and delays on aid, action from those responsible has not been taken to reduce the suffering. Indeed, as we see scenes in the north repeating themselves, the situation for children in Gaza is at rock bottom. With each repetition of last year's events, one grim repetition remains. More Gazan children will be killed.
Thank you very much, Jens and James. What a devastating situation for the children of Gaza. Before I open the floor to question, I just would like to also call your attention to the legal position paper, which has just been published today by the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry of the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel. And the press release is in your mailboxes. Thank you. So let me open the floor to questions in the room. I don't see hands up. So let me go to the platform. Agnes Pedrero, AFP.
Yes, hi, good morning, everybody. Thank you for taking my question. Just first, a small question on the, do you hear me? Yes? Yes. So on the report, on the source, I have a question about the people killed by Israeli forces and or settlers in the West Bank. You mentioned in the reporting period 104 Palestinians. What is the source, and also what is the source for the overall figure since October 2023? And then a general question to the UN. I wanted to ask you if there has been any United Nations reaction after the announcements of the death of Yahya Sinwar, and how do you think that this could change the situation and the war? Thank you.
Okay, I'll start with my colleagues. Maybe Jensen and James, you intervene too.
Just on hi Agnes, on the first part of your question, we cooperate, of course, in the West Bank, and have done for years, decades actually, with a vast number of humanitarian NGOs and also human rights organizations. So those are the sources that we use. They're credible. They've been tested over a very long time to be credible. I can try to get a little more granular detail how far we can, you know, explain this and send it to you. But this is these are very long-standing partnerships with organizations on the ground. Thanks.
I can add just in terms of West Bank, including East Jerusalem, since October last year, it's more than 160 children, including two Israelis, more than 160 Palestinian children, two Israelis, more than 450 Palestinian children wounded with live ammunition. Obviously, I would defer to Alessandra and the United Nations in terms of last night's events. What I can speak to is that I had multiple reports from civilians on the ground, from young people I had met, who thought this would mean the end of the war and whose emotions responded because they felt now the war would finally be over. That was their feeling.
Yeah, Agnes, on your second question, I think our message has not really changed. We have been consistently, the Secretary General and all senior officials have been consistently asking for the end or the halt of the fighting. We want civilians to be protected. We want, we've heard the Secretary General reacting to the news of yesterday on the famine situation in Gaza. We want improved humanitarian access. Jens has also and James have been speaking about that, when at a time where there is this risk of this tremendous famine. And we continue to want that any development that can help push us along that way, of course, is welcome. And that is what I can say about your second question. I see. Oh, Agnes, you have a follow-up. And then I'll go to the other questions.
Yes, thank you. Just a quick follow-up. So specifically on what you just say, Alessandra. So you would mean that, should I understand that you mean that the death of Sinwar last evening or last afternoon is considered as a welcome development?
I think that's anything that can lead us to a ceasefire and to improve of humanitarian aid is to be considered welcome. And that's about what I can say. Let's go to Lisa, who has a hand up. Lisa?
Yep, thanks. Okay, something for both Jens and James. Jens, I'd like to ask you whether Palestinians from the West Bank are still able to cross the line and go into Israel in order to work. And I was wondering specifically, you were talking about Israelis and Palestinians who were killed by Palestinians inside Israel, if I got this right. So how did that happen? Did the Israelis lose their guard yet again, unfortunately, and not see this coming? And then I'm wondering for you, James, and for both of you, actually, if you talk more about it, I'm wondering whether there is any improvement, if you see any improvement in terms of convoys, aid convoys entering the Gaza Strip. There's been a lot of international pressure about this. And James, are children dying because they're starving, because they're not getting food, and because they're forced to drink unclean water? I suppose adults may also be getting very ill from that as well. Thank you. I mean, do you see any chance, any movements of a ceasefire in the offing, or do you fear that what is happening right now is going to continue for a rather long time?
Thank you, Lisa. Of course, it requires work permits for Palestinians to go into Israel and work. About 160,000 people have lost their work permits, so they can't go into Israel, which is also leaving families without the income they previously had. This is livelihood for these people. And we have seen our colleagues in WFP warning about rising hunger, actually very dramatically numbers that they are projecting. It could push at least 600,000 people into food insecurity, they have said recently. These restrictions, which are not new to the West Bank, but which have been tightened enormously. And with the removal of work permits, of course, that closes it off completely. I think that's what I can say about that. On this specific incident that I or thing that I mentioned over the past year, when people in when Israelis had been killed, and I mentioned 16 members of the Israeli forces and 6 settlers had been killed by Palestinians, while and we track this as well, while Palestinians from the West Bank inside Israel proper had killed 16 Israelis, while in these attacks, 8 Palestinians had also been killed. So I hope that makes sense.
Lisa, thanks. In terms of any change, look, we need a systematic improvement, not a few trucks here or there. As I say, since early October, only 80 trucks have reached northern Gaza. That's compared to 460 in the same period in September. And September was by no means a high point in this. So we have seen a catastrophic decline in humanitarian aid for a population in the north, of which the bulk are women and children. Commercial trucks, there have been no commercial trucks to the north. Remembering, commercial trucks and humanitarian aid need to complement each other. Commercial trucks do things that the United Nations doesn't. They do fresh food and that things like that are absolutely essential. So we both have areas that need to be complementary. And there have been times in the south as well in the last month where there have been no commercial trucks whatsoever. So you'll recall, Lisa, that we were talking 500 trucks a day. These are some of the dips that we have made. Are children dying? The latest IPC shows 1 in 5 children suffering from the most severe forms of malnutrition. And again, that was taken in a period before we now had this forced displacement and increases of fighting. That's before commercial supplies were diminished again. So now we have large-scale displacement, infrastructure being increasingly decimated, agriculture, people have no money, things continue to worsen. Your question on ceasefire, of course, it is what we must continue to call for. It is what Gazans pray for. As I will never forget a woman explaining to me when she thought there would be a ceasefire in March when the Security Council voted that way, she said to her daughter, she could promise her daughter that night she would go to sleep and wake up. Now, that was not possible. That ceasefire was bombed and hope was blown away. I think what we need to look at if we're serious about a ceasefire is the only time there was a ceasefire, or that extended humanitarian pause in late November last year, more than 100 hostages were released, more than 100. Since then, through military means, through the decimation of Gaza, through the killing of something like 14 or 15,000 children, through the destruction of economy, of a health system, of schools, we have seen less than 10 hostages rescued.
I would like to add this also to what I said before to Agnes. Just call your attention to the post that our Secretary General put out yesterday on the IPC report, and again saying crossing points must open immediately, bureaucratic impediments must be removed, and law and order restored so that we can go ahead with our humanitarian assistance. Everything that can bring us to this, everything that can bring us to the ceasefire, to a larger access for humanitarian aid and to the immediate and unconditional release of the hostages has to be pursued and will be welcome. Any development in that sense will be welcome. And I add this to what I said before to Agnes. Lots of questions on the line, but I see Emma first. I'm always giving precedence to people in the room.
Thank you. Thank you, Jens and James, for those really powerful briefings. I was hoping for a bit more context on the attacks on Palestinians. Is it something that happens every year during the olive harvest, or is this year really, really exceptional? And do you know if the settlers involved in some of the recent attacks you described are those targeted by the sanctions against so-called extremist settlers? Any sign that those sanctions are having any effect whatsoever? Thank you.
Let me just take the first one. I think you need to repeat the second one for me. I'm not sure I understood that. Well, there have been settler violence for a very, very long time. And of course, the more settlers that come in, settlements that are going up illegally, by the way, the more violence we see. But this year is extraordinary. There's no question about it. That's why we highlight, and we particularly highlighted, that it's during the harvesting season, which is October, November, and which is, as I mentioned, a lifeline for tens of thousands of families. That's what they live from throughout the year. So it is, frankly, very concerning that it's not only attacks on people, but it's attacks on their olive groves as well. I mentioned trees that are uprooted, sawed off, and so on and so forth. That's very concerning.
And just to clarify, Jens, I was talking about the U.S. sanctions against Israeli settlers, targeting kind of the most extreme ones. I was wondering if you know whether they have been involved in any of these recent attacks, and whether you think those sanctions are having any real-world impact at all.
I do not know that, and we normally don't speak about sanctions that are not UN sanctions. So I'll keep it at that.
Okay, so Christian, you've been very patient.
Thank you, Alexandra. I would like to go back to Lebanon, and maybe Jens can fill us in here. Do you know how many people are actually left along the blue lines in those villages? And how are they reached by humanitarian aid? Andrea was talking about how UNIFIL is trying to facilitate those trips, but maybe you can give us a bit more detail here.
Thanks, Christian. I think we do have overnight a new situation report out. So we can double check on that, but otherwise we had some lines on that yesterday with the number, which of course keeps changing. As Andrea mentioned, we saw the big rush really at the very beginning. Very, very panicky. You recall the lines of cars trying to get away. It was very dramatic. And of course, as the area empties out of people, the numbers will gradually go down. But they are indeed very, very large. The way we deliver aid is, of course, through the collaboration with the Lebanese authorities, with the Lebanese Red Cross, with the Lebanese NGOs, with the international NGOs, with the UN agencies, and they are all there. And we do that within the framework of our flash appeal that we were briefed on earlier. It's a $426 million flash appeal. So that's the framework on that. How do we get to people in areas that are contested or where conflicts and bombings are going on? We have a humanitarian notification system. It is up and running. It is active and working both for static assets, that means offices, warehouses, and so on of humanitarian agencies, but also for movements. So those are the convoys. Particularly in the south, and Andrea mentioned a bit about the movements down there, which is, of course, where a lot of the fighting is going on. That humanitarian notification system includes notifications to the Lebanese armed forces and to the IDF. And that's exactly where we count on and rely on UNIFIL and their contacts in the area to make that smooth. And that is working.
So I don't think what I see here, I don't think we have the breakdown for those villages you are referring to, Christian. As a general figure, what we have from the Lebanese authorities, they say more than 2,300 people have been killed, over 11,000 people have been injured since October 2023, and more than 1.2 million people have been displaced. James, you wanted to add something?
Thanks so much. Only that, yes, of those 1.2 million, 400,000 are children. Children are always the first affected in a conflict like Lebanon's. Remembering winter is coming. There are deeply concerning echoes in the situation for children and families in Lebanon as those affected in the first stages of the war in Gaza. So again, as we've heard multiple times, if leaders are serious about the safety of children in the region, about hostages, then a ceasefire in Gaza is the quickest way to de-escalate.
Absolutely. John.
Yes, good morning. My question is to James. James, can you bring me up to speed, please? You mentioned that you've been unable to bring in prosthetics, or there was a lack of prosthetics in Gaza. Has UNICEF tried to bring in supplies and they've been turned back at the border, or what? And secondly, on the medical evacuation that this seven-year-old was rejected, how many of the medical evacuation requests have been turned down that have involved children? Thank you.
Thanks, John. So there were two main centres in Gaza that did work on prosthetics, and neither of those are operational. So I can find out for you about efforts to bring in prosthetics, though when speaking to those surgeons, the biggest challenge was the availability of people to actually do prosthetic work. That is a resource that is currently not in Gaza. It's impossible to overstate just how grave hospitals are in the war zone of places. When Lisa asked questions around malnutrition, parents with any child who is malnourished, who is sick, a breastfeeding mother who is deeply unwell, none of those people go to hospitals. In the same case, those children who've had amputations don't have any access to prosthetics. They do some basic rehabilitation in the hope that at some point they will be allowed to leave. John, I can only speak anecdotally, and I can share that with you offline. I've spoke to, in my last visit to Gaza, more than 20 different families with infuriating, heartbreaking stories of denials for those children to leave with clearly life-threatening injuries and deep, deep trauma. WHO is, of course, the lead in doing amazing work on those medevacs. That number of at least 10,000 people who require medevac is not desegregated by age, though, unfortunately. Thanks.
Christian, I think you have a little bit more on that. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alessandra, and thanks very much to James, UNICEF, and to Archer here for these absolutely horrifying and harrowing reports. Just a few data. I don't have it on aggregated on children, but just for the evacuations. 15,600 patients requiring urgent medical evacuations, with only 5,138 evacuated so far. So a third, 30% of those needing urgent medical evacuations have been approved for evacuation so far. And almost half of them had cancer, 40% war injuries in 2023 only. So I don't even have figures on 2024 for this segment. And 200 had kidney diseases. Since 7 May, so that's now nearly half a year, only 231 patients have been evacuated. So the massive bulk of this, only 30%, had been before 7 of May.
Thank you very much. I don't see other questions for our colleague, but before we leave the Middle East, oh, sorry, Hassan, I didn't see your hand. Go ahead.
Thank you. Jans, I have a question. How many Palestinian children have been killed so far? Thank you.
In Gaza, the West Bank, or
Gaza, in West Bank, Palestinian children.
Since the 7th of October.
Far, far too many. The latest figure that UNICEF uses, and it's conservative, is 14,100 girls and boys having been killed in Gaza. That has not been updated for more than a month. Now, that is reportedly killed, given all the complexities, but as we've spoken many times, we have, unfortunately, trust in the numbers because of past crises and how they have been in sync with our much more thorough triangular verification. So, unfortunately, that number will hold true. There are many, many more under rubble. On a conservative measure, around 35 to 40 girls and boys are killed every day in Gaza since the 7th of October.
Thank you, James. Have I missed other hands up? I don't think so. So thank you very much, colleagues. But before we leave the Middle East, I have I would like to remind you of the invitation that we have distributed to you, the invitation to the annual UN International Media Seminar on Peace in the Middle East. This is organized by our Department of Global Communication together with UNOG this year, and it will be held on the 1st of November in room 26 of the Palais des Nations. As you know, for over three decades, the International Media Seminar has created a platform to enhance dialogue and understanding between Palestinian and Israeli media representatives. And at this very time of alarmingly escalated crisis, participants will come together for a whole day to discuss a range of issues related to two main themes: safety of journalists, key tenets of press freedom, and behind the headlines of Gaza, media challenges and perspective. The seminar will be opened by our Director General, Tatiana Valovaya, and will be chaired by Melissa Fleming, Under Secretary General for Global Communications. We will very soon publish on the website the full program with all the speakers, but you have the invitation in your mailbox. Peter is here. Please register with him. It's not indispensable to register, but we would like to know that you're coming. And of course, you don't need Indico. You have the badge, but it's just to know that you are going to be with us on that important event. So thank you very much to my colleagues on the podium. Unfortunately, the Middle East is not the only crisis in the world. And there are so many more, and I would like to ask our colleague to come to the podium, Kennedy Omondi. You know, Kennedy is the spokesperson of IOM, and he has an update on the situation of Haiti. Very difficult situation too, and we will hear more from him for IOM. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, everyone. Just to provide a brief update, we're already aware of the situation of the global crisis in the world. And unfortunately, it has been mentioned, it's not only Middle East. And I'd like to just draw attention to currently the situation in Haiti. The country in itself has been ravaged by violence, with gangs terrorizing entire communities, leaving behind devastation and fear. Haiti is in the grip of unprecedented crisis. Since the beginning of 2014, gang-related violence has claimed more than 3,600 lives. Just 2 weeks ago, a brutal attack on the town of Ponte Sonde took the lives of at least 115 more innocent people. The violence has forced over 700,000 people to flee their homes, creating a massive displacement crisis. There has been 22% increase in the number of internally displaced people since June alone. The initial numbers in the beginning of June was standing at around 580,000, and since then the numbers increased to 700,000 within this short period. In the past 7 months, gang violence has forced, of course, the 100,000 people to flee their homes, particularly in the western part of the capital, Port-au-Prince. Children, mothers, fathers, and elders, none have been spared. They flee with whatever they can carry, often losing everything in their possession, including the sense of safety. Our team met, of course, with one of the survivors, an elderly woman from Port-au-Prince who, like so many others, was driven from her home by relentless violence. Her testimonies are chilling. She describes her former life as a walking nightmare, each day with the sound of gunfire, each night wondering if she or someone in her family would be next. Her story is heartbreaking, but unfortunately, this is not unique to most Haitians. It is a story of thousands of them living in fear and displacement. Over half of those displaced are children, and the humanitarian needs are overwhelming. Nearly half of Haiti's population, 5.5 million people are in urgent need of humanitarian aid. Food insecurity has skyrocketed amidst all this, with 5.4 million Haitians struggling to feed themselves and even their families. Health services on the other side has collapsed, schools have been forced to close, and the basic services that hold the society together are now almost non-existent in many parts of the country. Yet despite this immense hardship, the people of Haiti remain resilient. Communities have opened up their doors to those displaced in the violence. Currently, over 83% of the displaced individuals are being sheltered by host families. And these families are often already crowded and in impoverished conditions. The host communities are the unsung heroes of this crisis, but they too were struggling under the weight of the immense need, food shortages, overwhelming healthcare facilities, and the dwindling resources. In 2024, the affected population started to flee the capital more and more. Currently, 70% of the displaced population are living outside the capital, Port-au-Prince. IOM is in the front line, working alongside local partners to provide life-saving assistance and social services. Since February, the organization has delivered 6 million liters of clean water, distributed essential supplies to over 50,000 people, and provided psychosocial and medical care to tens and thousands of displaced individuals. But despite all this effort, the crisis is escalating and the needs are growing faster and faster than the resources that are currently available. We are facing a funding shortfall as all the other organizations when it comes to the crises that are ongoing in the world. The funding gap currently stands at 35 million, and it's threatening the ability to provide basic assistance to the Haitians that need it the most. We remain committed in working alongside the Haitian government, local and international partners to provide life-saving aid and find long-term solution to those displaced. But we cannot do this alone. Haitian people deserve to look forward with hope and not despair. We need to stand with them and help them rebuild their lives with dignity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kennedy. Let me see if there are questions for IOM in the room. Let me go to the platform, Paula.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for that presentation. I would like to know if Haitians are still leaving the country, at what rates, if you have any numbers on that. Are they, and how are they leaving the country? Are they still transiting through the Darien Gap? I also wanted to know more generally if you could provide some information about that route and flows through the jungle, you know, that bridges Colombia from Panama in the run-up of the U.S. elections.
The situation in the Darien Gap is a bit complex in itself, in the sense that it's not only touches on Haitians, but also different nationalities that are trying to cross the Darien Gap. I'm more than happy to share with you the numbers of the people who currently are on the route in itself. I don't have them with me here, but I'm more than happy to share with you the current figures on this. On the situation of Haitians currently being forced to flee. As you're already aware, the situation in the country in itself is not a stable one, and so everyone is trying to basically try and find stability in neighboring cities out of Port-au-Prince. However, the number of people that are currently crossing out of the country, I don't have that at the moment, but I can share with you as well.
Thank you very much. Jamie, is that a hand?
Hello, Mr. Amandi. Thank you for coming to see us. I had just two questions. The first is we saw yesterday, I think it was yesterday or the other day, sorry, there was a shootout between between the Haitian and Kenyan police. And I'm just wondering, how concerned are you that the peacekeeping mission there and you know, shortcomings with it or troubles with it may prompt more outflows or a greater crisis situation, if we can call it that, in Haiti? And then the second question has to do with repatriations. How involved is IOM in returning people to Haiti from places that, is there a role for you, and are you involved in that at all?
I'll start with the first situation. Of course, we are all aware that there's a multinational team that is working on to restore peace in Haiti. And in the past couple of months, we have seen the impact, and we have seen also the impact that it's having on those displaced. Just as I was mentioning 2 weeks ago, we had the mass murder of almost 115 people being killed by the gang. So the situation in itself is it's dire, but the peacekeeping multinational mission has its role on that, and also for us as IOM is basically to ensure that all those who are affected, and we are talking about 700,000, are able to access service and are able to basically live their lives comfortably. On the second issue that you did mention, you are talking about the number of people that IOM is supporting to move out of Haiti.
I was thinking more entering the church to Haiti.
The whole situation of returns into Haiti, as you already know, Haiti and the current situation they are going in is not really a suitable country for basically anyone to come back and return to. So what we are basically doing is that we are working within Haiti to make sure that we support the life-saving assistance that is required within the country, but also working also with within the neighboring countries, but not on the returns. We are aware, of course, that there are started forced returns that are being that have been ongoing, and what we basically see and what we basically want to put out is that Haiti in itself is not in a situation where people can actually be brought back to, and we are asking, of course, the neighboring countries to ensure that they protect, of course, the people within their territories, and also to urging them to basically abide by international law and its principles, especially the principle of non-refoulement. Thank you.
Yeah. Just wanted to clarify that I was actually referring to, there was a shootout the other day, and actually it wasn't between Haitian and Kenyan police, but it was a Haitian gang leader, I think, who was injured in a shootout with the, so just for the record.
Well noted. So there are no other questions for you, Kennedy. I don't see any on the platform. So thank you very much for reminding us of this very dire situation and putting them back on the limelight. Thank you. Just a couple of more announcements from me. Just a reminder of the UNCTAD press conference on Tuesday, 22nd of October at 2:30. This is for the presentation of the review of Maritime Transport 2024. Title is Navigating Maritime Choke Points. And you will have Jan Hoffman, the UN Trade and Development Head of the Trade Logistics Branch, speaking to you. And then a reminder that the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women is examining today the report of Cuba. They are left with one report, the one of Benin, on the 21st of October. And on the 25th of October, they will hold an informal public meeting with state parties and launch the general recommendations on the equal and inclusive representation of women in decision-making systems. That will be the end of this 89th session of the committee. And lastly, the Human Rights Committee is concluding this morning the review of the report of Pakistan, and they are left with the report to examine the report of Greece, France, Turkey, and Ecuador. This is what I had for you. If you don't have other questions for me or for other colleagues, I don't see any hands up. Thank you very much for following in this briefing. I remind you that we have a photo op in a few minutes at door 40 for Pink October. As you know, this is the month that the international community put its attention on breast cancer prevention and treatment. And there is a photo op at door 40 with pink ribbons if you want to go and take a shot. Otherwise, I thank you all very much and have a nice weekend. Thank you very much. And I'll ask the students to stay so that we can have a little chat. Thanks. Bye.